is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in today for Dan Hurley. Cincinnati officials delayed a plan to remove a homeless camp from underneath a downtown highway overpass, at least for now. After meeting with stakeholders, including people who live at the camp, the city will not start clearing it until Wednesday morning. That cleaning was scheduled to begin today. While this is a temporary reprieve, one agency that assists the homeless says there's not enough capacity to house the people living at the camp. Joining me to discuss this issue is WCPO reporter Lucy May, and you can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Lucy, it's a pleasure to have you back on Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about what happened yesterday with the reprieve and the temporary hold on clearing the camp, but to start out, if you can't just describe the camp and sort of where it's located, there's part of it that is very visible and part of it that's not quite so visible.
Right. And actually, the part that is more visible is not the part that has been under discussion this week. There are people probably have noticed tents on 3rd Street across from the office buildings. You can kind of see the ballpark in the background. What the city has been talking about is what the folks who live there refer to as a tent city that's near 3rd and Plum Streets, but it's kind of under Fort Washington Way. So the tents are mostly set up under what's essentially a bridge. That way they're sheltered from the elements. But there are many tents down there. There are couches, mattresses set up. I mean, a lot of stuff has built up under there over what is estimated to be at least 5 or 6 months that the first few people started gathering, and then it just kind of got bigger and bigger and bigger.
And there was, we were talking about this off the air, but some speculation on how this, it started, I think I heard, with maybe about 10 folks, and it's now up to about 40. And what we were talking about is how it grew so large.
Yeah. And what I've heard is similar to what you've heard, I know, it's that as soon as the city kind of leaves these folks alone, there's a snowball effect. So once the message kind of spreads that, hey, there's a place with, you know, shelter from the elements where we can set up our tents or set up our sleeping bags, and the city's not going to make us leave, the word gets out. And a lot of people experiencing homelessness, when they're sleeping outside, they do want to be in groups because they feel like there's safety in numbers, especially if the groups all get along. That, you know, when you're near downtown, there's better lighting. You are closer to Fountain Square and all the banks and those different things where you might want to go either to Panhandle or use a bathroom or something. So once it kind of goes for a while, there's this snowball effect, and it built up kind of pretty quickly and got real big.
I know one of the, I believe they call him Bison.
Yes.
I don't know if he's the leader, so to speak, of this group. But you, he would describe that this is his family.
Right.
He's alone here, and this group of people is his family.
Right, right. It's become his community. And he's Bison's a real interesting person. I've talked with him a couple times, and a number of my colleagues at Channel 9 have too. He describes himself alternately as the mayor, the chief tribal leader, and the king of the community. So he's definitely got a leadership position, but he was very important. He was one of the people who met with Councilwoman Tamaya Denard on Tuesday to kind of explain how the people staying at the tent city were really feeling about it and to offer some suggestions and really kind of make some requests of the city.
Do we know what made this situation different? Because it's not uncommon for these camps to be located under bridges and overpasses. I know I saw one routinely, the Reading Road ramp to 471 under a couple of the bridges there. Normally, they just come in, clear them out, move the folks out. You don't hear anything about that. What was different? Do we know what was different in this situation? Was it the sheer size?
I think part of it was the size. And I also think that it got big kind of in this hidden way, and all of a sudden, people who live and work there really started to notice. I'm sure you've seen the report that Jason Barron, who's the executive director of Red Bike, he's also a board member at Downtown Cincinnati Incorporated, a member of their Safe and Clean Committee, and he lives near 3rd and Plum in one of the residential developments there, as a lot of people do. And residents and businesses that are located near there started to complain. They said that there was a lot of public urination and defecation. Jason's report said that there's a surface parking lot that's called Parking Lot A, real fancy name, that the county owns. And his report said that the county actually had to rope off about 20 spaces because of the buildup of human excrement, that the spaces were no longer viably usable. The monthly parking went down because people didn't want to park where there were, you know, there was excrement, which you understand. And the people living there started to feel like there were more unpleasant interactions with people who lived at the tent city. They talked about public sex acts and observing drug use in public. And along with the excrement, it sort of, I think, hit a tipping point based on the size and on this report that Jason submitted to the mayor and the city manager and a number of other officials through DCI.
And I'm pulling something out of my memory here, and I don't quite remember the time frame, but I'm thinking about a year ago that the city had also, in that same area, I believe, maybe removed some landscaping and benches because of similar concerns.
Right. And that was sort of more—
On Third Street,
I think. On Third Street. It's kind of above ground, so more along the kind of main Walnut in that area. And there are tents there now. And what police had told my colleague Tom McKee on Monday of this week was that after this camp was clear, that they were going to be going next to the tents that were set up on 3rd Street in a more visible location. So who know, I don't know what that timing is going to be like now that there is an extension for the folks at this tent city.
What do we know? City Council had a special meeting yesterday where they were supposed to, when they did pass a motion to extend the time frame for this camp to be cleared. It's still going to be cleared. It's just now going to be Wednesday morning instead of what was scheduled to be today. But the city has also promised to do some other things.
Yeah, the city has, and this charge was really led by Councilwoman Tamaya Denard. She felt like 72-hour notice wasn't enough for people. She was hearing a lot from not only people at the camp, but from advocacy groups like Maslow's Army and the Greater Cincinnati Coalition for the Homeless, who said that that just wasn't enough time. It's real unclear to me how things are going to be different with a few extra days. I know the city manager and Councilwoman Denard and some other folks are planning to go to the tent city on Monday and meet with the people there and try to get a better understanding of their concerns and needs. Kevin Finn, who's the CEO of Strategies to End Homelessness, has told me a number of times over the week that outreach workers tell him that many of the people staying at this tent city don't want to go to shelters, even if there's room at the shelter house facility for men, the Dave and Rebecca Barron Center in Queensgate, for single men to go there now. The women's shelter in Mount Auburn, the Esther Marie Hatton Center, is full and they can't really take any more people. But up until very recently, they were taking anybody who would come, and the people just didn't want to stay there for a variety of reasons. So, as you know, Prince of Peace Church on Tuesday reached an agreement with the city to open a temporary shelter at their Prince of Peace Lutheran Church in Over the Rhine on Ray Street. They operate a shelter in the wintertime and came to an agreement with the city. The city was going to pay them to open it for between 6 and 8 weeks to serve specifically the people dislocated from this evacuation of this area. But the question is, would they go there? Because they don't want to stay in shelters for a variety of reasons.
And even that yesterday turned into Prince of Peace
withdrew.
And it almost sounded to me like then the acting city manager issued a memo saying, wait a minute, we had a contract. And it was almost like, were you going to sue a church to enforce a city contract?
Yeah. It got awkward fast. But I think Prince of Peace, you know, the Pastor John who runs the church there didn't talk a lot beyond his statement. But, you know, it's not hard to imagine that if in 6 or 8 weeks the people staying there still had no place to go and the contract with the city expired and the church ended up being the ones to tell them, sorry, now you've got to leave, that would put the church in a very difficult position.
513-419-7100. Stephanie, you had a comment. Go ahead.
Yes. I have such high regard for Maslow's Army and what they're trying to do. But what I think a lot of people don't understand is there's a lack of empathy here. These people are good people. They have fallen on hard times, and we're not there to judge what their situations are. With the healthcare debacle in this country, it can take very little to just ruin your life. And it's a shame that, like everyone has said before, with all the empty buildings that we have, with the soccer coming, why can't we get some of the money from the soccer league to, you know, get some decent housing, decently priced housing for these folks? These are people. These are God's children, and they don't need to be judged or looked down upon. And when I see the comments on WCPO Channel 9, I've been in Cincinnati for 4 years. I thought it was a liberal, diverse city, and I'm just sickened by some of the comments that I read. And when these horrible things happen to someone that you love, maybe you'll have some empathy and understand that this is not by choice.
Stephanie, we appreciate your comment. And some of that sort of sounds like what Tamaya Denard was saying yesterday during the council meeting.
Yes, it sure does. She has encouraged a more holistic look. And I think what she said was, let's view these people as people and not what their experience is right now or what their circumstances are right now, their environment. And Maslow's Army, in fact, has been trying to work with the city to open what they call a day center where they would have daytime programming for people. Their big vision also is to have a center that would address people trying to eliminate heroin addictions. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, terrible circumstances affecting people right now. So they've been working on that.
Obviously, the short-term solution is that this camp could be cleared up by Wednesday morning. Officials are promising to work on a long-term solution. But I thought it was interesting yesterday, Councilmember Young said, this is not a problem that is unique to the city of Cincinnati, and no other city in the country has found a long-term solution to the problem.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, there were a lot of people at that council meeting yesterday voicing support and empathy and compassion, like Stephanie was just talking about. There were also some residents of downtown who said, look, we've, you know, had some unpleasant experiences, and we think something needs to be done. One of the solutions that Tamaya Denard has talked about, at least as an interim measure, is opening what she refers to as a community where people would be welcome to pitch their tents, almost like a campground that's somewhere in the city, and having a portalette there and having garbage receptacles. So it would make it easier for people in that circumstance to, you know, stay clean and sanitary. The issue there is what Kevin Finn of Strategies and Homelessness has talked to me about is, as soon as you set up an area like that, it becomes a magnet for people who either can't get access to shelter or prefer not to stay in shelter. So it's almost hard to predict how big a space you would need because there's a snowball effect that it could grow pretty quickly, pretty big.
You could assume that you had plenty of space and a few weeks later find out that it in fact is not large
right,
enough.
Right, right.
We've been talking about the homeless camp underneath the downtown highway ramp. It's now scheduled to be closed and cleaned up Wednesday. My guest was WCPO reporter Lucy May. Thank you. And you probably hear Marianne Zalesnik and I say Lucy's name a lot during our fund drives. You're a frequent contributor and an avid listener, and we appreciate that as well, too.
I'm a loyal fan. Thank you, Jay.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in today for Dan Hurley. Ohio this week executed a man for a murder committed in Cincinnati in the 1980s. The execution of Robert Van Hook by lethal injection was carried out in Lucasville. Van Hook was sentenced to die for killing David Self. Meanwhile, Hamilton County Republicans and others this week submitted more than 38,000 petition signatures in their effort to repeal an increase in the county sales tax approved earlier this year. Joining me now are Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight and WVXU reporters Bill Reinhart and Howard Wilkinson. You can join the conversation. Our number is 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cameron, let me start with you. You were in Lucasville to cover the execution. I mentioned that the inmate that was executed was Robert Van Hook. Tell us a little bit about his case.
Yeah, so in 1980s, he was charged with a homicide, and he was convicted pretty quickly. He was trying to get a insanity plea, and it just didn't work out. The circumstances of the homicide were kind of controversial at the time because he was in a bar that was frequented by homosexuals. He picked up a person. They started talking at the bar. That person, David Self, who was the victim, took Van Hook back to his Hyde Park apartment, and during some point, Van Hook strangled Self until he passed out unconscious, and then nearly disemboweled him with a knife. And it was Van Hook's defense attorney, who is still around, his name's Stu Matthews, said it was a gruesome murder. and he needed so they went through and he pled insanity. He said during the trial at the time that he was he thought David Self was a Viet Cong soldier and that he was being a war hero or something like that, some type of delusional situation. In later appeals, it came out that there was some talk of homosexual panic, but the judges at the time noted that Van Hook had made it a habit of robbing homosexual men since the time he was a teenager. And then during the execution or after the execution this week, his defense team said noted that Van Hook had a history of child abuse, mental, physical, sexual abuse during his childhood that they felt was never really noted in any of the trial or any of the appeals cases.
As always is the case, prior to the lethal injection, the condemned is allowed to make a final statement. What did Van Hook have to say?
Well, he was oddly calm when he walked into the room. It was the only execution I've ever witnessed, so I say oddly calm just because it's odd to me. I don't know if it's typical for people to be calm or not. But he was calm when he walked in, and they hooked up the IVs and all that stuff, and he was basically expressionless until they said, you know, it's time, you know, do you want to make a final statement? At which point he turned his head on the table toward the galleries where people are watching, and he said he started sobbing immediately, and he said that he was sorry for taking the brother away from the one of the family members, and he said that he hoped that they would be able to meet again. He also recited a Norse prayer, an adapted Norse prayer that was quoted in a movie one time in the 90s. And he and then they shut off the mic, and he was singing. We couldn't tell what he was singing because of the glass and everything in the way, but he sang for several minutes, and then he went silent. And then a couple minutes later, some doctors came in to check to make sure he was unconscious. I don't know if they're doctors or not. Medical personnel came in to check to make sure he was unconscious. And at that point, he was still breathing. Maybe a few minutes later, he started gasping and kind of wheezing. We could hear that through the glass. It was loud enough to hear. And then a few minutes later after that, they pronounced him dead. So,
and I think there are three sets of witnesses, correct? There's there's representatives of the victim, representatives of the condemned, and then media witnesses. But you're all separated, correct?
No. There's two separate rooms to separate the victim's witnesses from the condemned's witnesses. It's like a panel that separates them, but the media kind of stand in the back of this room. The two separate galleries are connected, and the media can kind of walk back and forth a little bit, but we're just kind of all standing behind the witnesses for the different families.
Now, did you volunteer to do this, or were you selected to do this?
Well, I did volunteer for it. It was something that I thought journalists typically have a bit of a bucket list of things that they feel like they might want to witness if they want to ever report on them. I report on crime and courts and homicides all the time. If I were an education reporter, I would have probably felt no compulsion to go to a execution. But because it's something that is sort of slightly related to what I do day in and day out, I felt like it might give me some more perspective for my job as a whole.
Was it what you expected?
It was. There's a very, very strict process about how everything goes down, set out by the Ohio Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. They have a very strict rules. They have a very kind of stringent process. It's the same every single time. So I was able to talk to both people at the Department of Corrections, and I was able to read some other stories from reporters who'd covered ones in the past, and get a pretty firm sense of what I was going to be seeing and what the day was going to be like. But I don't think anything can prepare someone to literally watch someone die in front of you in that kind of way.
What about the scene outside?
I was kind of sequestered inside. They kind of keep you in there. But we did have a photographer, a journalist named Kara Owsley outside. And there were some protesters. There were between 20 and 30 protesters, different anti-death penalty groups. Van Hook's sister was actually among the protesters. And she had been she was a Cincinnati resident who had left and gone to move to Las Vegas. And but she came back and spent the week, taking time to visit with her brother and then also to be involved in the protest as they took place that day. So there were some protesters out there, but there weren't any conflicts or anything like that. It was just a solemn kind of protest.
Howard Wilkinson and Bill Reinhardt are in the studio, and the reason they're here is because they have both witnessed executions. Howard, let me start with you. What was your experience, and how maybe does it compare to what you've heard Cameron talk about?
Well, Cameron's right. I mean, there is a certain sameness to all of these, and the state of Ohio does that on purpose. I was involved in the execution of Alton Coleman. And Alton Coleman and his girlfriend, companion, Deborah Brown, went on a rampage through six states.
I think this was in the 80s?
It was from May to July in 1984. And they killed eight people. Eight people died. And the people were in several different states. And one of them was a woman in Norwood. And she and her husband were sitting at home minding their own business when these people came into their home on the pretense of trying to buy a camper from them that they were going to sell. And she was brutally murdered. I mean brutally murdered. And he was her husband was left within an inch of his life. And the states got together and they looked at it and they said, okay, who's got the strongest case? And they decided that Ohio did. And Ohio had Alton Coleman in prison. And so it was decided that the sentence would be carried out. The trial would take place in Ohio. The sentence would be carried out in Ohio. And it was in 2002 after a number of appeal attempts. I was not specifically – well, I was asked because I was one of the very few reporters in town, and especially at the Enquirer, who had covered part of the Alton Coleman murder spree. So I had familiarity with it. So they specifically asked for me to be on the media witnesses, and I never asked for it, didn't really expect it. But I did it, and it was not an easy experience. It's not easy to, as Cameron says, to watch as the state of Ohio pumps, in this case, $44.23 worth of drugs into a human being and kill them.
Now, Alton, Coleman's, mm-hmm. While we're looking at timelines, the execution this week was a crime in 1985. Alton Coleman's were about the same time, although he was executed in 2002, but he ended up, even though there were some appeals, he ended up dropping his appeals.
He did at one point, after, unsuccessfully.
Yeah, and the Van Hook case, his appeals were actually, he had an appeal that was upheld at one point, which is part of the reason why his case has been, it's 33 years gap between the crime and the execution. Part of the reason it's so long is because he actually did win an appeal, which was then overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court later on. So, I mean, there'd been even more back and forth with appeals on his case than some others.
Bill, let's work you in here. Tell us your experience covering up.
Not all that different from theirs. I witnessed the execution of William Smith in 2005. He was executed for the murder of Mary Bradford in 1987. The two had been dancing together and went home, had sex. Eventually, they had a fight over cocaine and money. He stabbed her and then stole stereo, came back, and if I recall correctly, stabbed her again until she was dead. The room was split in half with just a curtain down the middle, with his family on one side and the reporters, state witnesses, and the victim's family on the other side. He gave a very, very lengthy last statement, to the point where he was just starting to ramble, and they cut him off. He was stalling, essentially. I know myself and the other two reporters, I believe it was Jeff Hirsch from Local 12, and Jeff, if you're listening, call in and correct me. We had trouble keeping up with all of his last words. We wanted to get it right. I mean, this was the last things this man was ever going to say, and we wanted to get it right. And afterwards, we had to compare notes. And fortunately, where one of us dropped off, someone else could pick up so we could have a good record of what his final thoughts were. And when they did give him the injection, it was very anticlimactic. It was just a moment. He was just laying there, and suddenly you realize, oh, he's not breathing anymore, and that was it.
In the case of Coleman, it was very easy to record his last words, because all he did from the moment he walked into that room until his last breath was repeat the 23rd Psalm over and over and over and over again, and that's all he did. And in the middle of that is when they gave him his injection, and he continued to do that until he could no longer speak. And the last thing that we saw of him was his chest rose, and he exhaled, and he was dead. And they closed these black curtains, and the doctors come in, a doctor came in to declare that he was dead. They opened it up, and the superintendent of the prison made the official announcement. Alton Coleman died at 10:41 a.m. or whatever it was, and that was it. And he was just lying there. It was a very emotional thing.
In the newsroom, we were talking about this. I said, would you do it again? Howard says never.
No.
Bill said maybe. So why never, Howard?
Number one, you know, I'm not a crime reporter. That's not my beat. And I don't expect to – I didn't much – it's not a matter of whether you oppose or support capital punishment. Is just a very, very unpleasant experience. And okay, I did it. It was my job, but I'm not going to go out of my way to do this again. I mean, if I were asked to do it, if I were assigned to do it, I would do it. But I really have no desire to see that again.
Bill?
About the same. I'm not going to, you know, jump up and down and say, ooh, pick me. But if I'm assigned, I'll go. It's the job.
What about you, Cameron?
I feel like if it were a case that I had been following for a long time, I would probably feel obligated to kind of follow it through to the end. However, there haven't been any death penalty cases that I've covered. So luckily, that's not in my – it won't be in my future as of yet. But
and I think we found out today the next – execution was in, I believe, September, October, was another Hamilton County case. But today, Ohio Governor John Kasich commuted the sentence of Raymond Tibbetts. So instead of the death penalty, now he has been granted
He was scheduled to die earlier this year, and there was a temporary kind of clemency offered, and then I find it hard to believe that the timing of Kasich's decision wasn't affected by the Van Hook execution. I wonder if there had maybe waited.
The one thing about doing this is, you know, you are in there representing not just your news organization, but all news organizations, and by extension, the public. And you go, you leave that room and you go into a larger room where the news media is gathered, the other news media who are not witnesses, and you have to stand there and give them essentially what is a pool report on what happened. And that's why, as Bill was saying, you better get it right.
Yeah, and it is very that part of it was actually probably the most nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Because it was most of these people, most of the media that were there were all we all know each other, we all work together,
mm-hmm.
and we were so you're talking to people that you work with side by side every day about something that you just witnessed that was frankly, yeah, like Howard said, quite unpleasant.
Let's change topics here quickly. Howard, this week Hamilton County Republicans and some others filed a lot of petition signatures with the Hamilton County Auditor, and their goal is to repeal the 0.2% increase in the county sales tax that was approved earlier this year by two members of the Hamilton County Commission.
Two Democratic members of the County Commission, and the one Republican voted against it. And obviously, this petition initiative that was launched several days after the two commissioners had voted for this tax increase was run by the Hamilton County Republican Party and organizations like COAST, anti-tax, anti-spending groups, conservatives in general. And the party went out and hired a circulator, a firm that brings people in to circulate petitions. They say that makes up a minority of the signatures that they actually turned in. But, you know, it's probably a significant number. Now, we're going to have to wait a couple of weeks before we know whether or not they have reached the 23,629 valid signatures they need.
I was going to say outline the process because one would assume that if you're going to put something on the ballot, you would give your signatures to the Hamilton County Board of Elections because that's who does elections.
But not in this case.
This case, they went to Hamilton County Auditor's Office.
Because this is a referendum, because it's a different kettle of fish. And the Ohio Revised Code makes it very clear that in a case like this, the petitions go to the county auditor, who really doesn't do anything with them except have them there for public inspection.
And so you can drop by during business hours and look at them.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure there are people doing that right now. I'm sure there are Democrats, you know, who are looking at those petitions very closely to see whether or not not checking the names, but checking whether or not the petitions themselves were filled out correctly, because there are some very arcane rules about how those forms have to be filled out.
Literally, the T's have to be crossed and the I's dotted exactly right.
And they'll be looking. So they have 10 days to do that. After 10 days, then they're delivered to the Board of Elections. The Board of Elections' function then is to check the names and to check to make sure whether or not those indeed are there are indeed 23,629 verified voters in Hamilton County who signed those petitions.
Bill, let me switch to you.
I got a quick question. Is that 10 business days or 10 day calendar days?
That's 10 calendar days.
Okay, because the 10 days would be a Saturday. It'd be the 28th. So
they'll work over the week. They will work over the weekend to do this. They've made that clear. They said, you know, we'll work until it's over.
Bill, there was some speculation going around on Wednesday, the day – I think it was Wednesday. Yeah, these were turned in, that perhaps the two commissioners who supported this, Todd Fortune and Denise Driehaus, would withdraw it prior to these petitions being filed, but that didn't happen.
Hamilton County Commission President Todd Fortune said absolutely not. That would be incorrect. He said to do anything with this because of political pressure or because of possible political outcomes, the idea being that putting this on the ballot would draw more Republicans to the polls and could help Steve Chabot in his reelection bid versus the challenger, Democrat Aftab Puerval. And Todd Portoon says, no, that was never a consideration. When we put it on the ballot, it should not be a consideration to take it off the ballot.
What about the politics? Because, I mean, if this were 2017, 2019, 2021, an off-year election when there weren't big Republican versus Democrat races on the ballot, would this petition effort have been launched?
Probably not, or, you know, it would have not been such a priority for the Hamilton County Republican Party. You know, Bill said the magic word, AFTAB Pervo. They're concerned about him, the Democratic clerk of courts who's running against Steve Chabot, you know, the longtime congressman. So there are many Republicans who see this as a way of getting more Republican voters out to vote, not only to vote down this tax increase, but to vote for Chabot, Chris Monzel, and other Republican candidates. And it was interesting when they had their press conference outside the county administration building, they had a bunch of people, young people with hand-painted signs that basically said, vote against the AFTAX.
AFTAX.
That's right, AFTAX. And I asked them about that. I said, what? He didn't have anything to do with passing this, did he? And I said, no, he didn't. And then he shortly thereafter came out with a statement saying that he doesn't support the thing. He's not going to vote for it. I don't know if that, you know, the Republicans say, oh, you just said that because you saw this big stack of papers that we brought to the auditor's office. But he certainly did not have anything to do with creating or passing this tax increase.
And I think this has even divided elected officials. I know Judge Norbert Nadel, a few years ago, there was something we used to get daily emails about some sort of tax increase. You know, his line was enough is enough. Mm-hmm. But I think he's supportive of this
that's
tax.
My understanding. Right.
And there are some Democrats who are opposed, as you mentioned, AFTAB Pureval.
Yes. Yes, there are. And there are going to be more – there'll be more – Democrats who are opposed, and there'll be more Republicans who are, you know.
Is it the process is underway? Could the two commissioners still withdraw this if they wanted to? Even if it's certified that it is going to be a referendum, they've got enough signatures. Could they still say, "Okay, you win. We're just going to drop it"?
Well, they could do whatever they want, you know. But that's there are political consequences to that too. That would be an extreme political risk.
What are the chances that those signatures are going to be valid?
I think, you know, with the number that they have, they say around 37,800. They think that probably maybe 30% are not valid signatures. That would not be an unusual figure for a petition drive. And I think that would put them just right on the edge of qualifying. It could go either way. So I think that we're going to have to wait and see just how good these people are at getting signatures of real voters in Hamilton County.
We've been talking about this week's execution in Ohio and efforts to repeal a Hamilton County sales tax increase with Cincinnati Inquirer Breaking News reporter Cameron Knight and WVXU reporters Bill Reinhardt and Howard Wilkinson. This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in for Dan Hurley. It's our Friday news review. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents have increased their activity in greater Cincinnati, and it's been 3 years since Sam DeBose was shot and killed by former UC police officer Ray Tenzing following a traffic stop just off the UC campus. His children are moving forward 3 years after his death. Joining me to discuss these issues is Cincinnati Inquirer race and communities reporter Mark Knuth. Mark, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
You had an article published, I think it was Tuesday, about ICE activity increasing locally. And I loved your first sentence, it's only a matter of time. What's only a matter of time?
You know, I think a high-profile workplace enforcement or a raid or larger-scale arrests, given kind of the clustering nature of the communities. I think they've brought in civilian contractors from the GEO group, and they're freeing up, from all accounts that I've been able to get, freeing up their sworn agents to be out in the neighborhoods and in the communities more doing enforcement action. And I think it's, you know, given what happened in Northern Ohio, what's happened around the country in Iowa and other states, it's only, again, a matter of time until something of a larger scale action occurs in this area.
Well, and the GEO Group is what?
The GEO Group is a private, that's a good question, it's a private prison company. They have some accounts, $500 million worth of contracts with ICE alone. They've been involved in the custody or the warehousing, for lack of a better term, of the immigrant children, the migrant children that have been separated from their parents. They have a number of detainment centers and jails around the country that work that are ICE facilities.
And you also wrote that the ICE is more visible in Cincinnati neighborhoods. Can you kind of describe what that looks like?
From what I understand, you know, they know where the unauthorized immigrants are, and they have, you know, under the Obama administration, known criminals, known felons were the enforcement priority. They were the arrest priority. And under the new administration of President Trump, anyone who even if they have no other criminal record, anyone who is here without authorization or permission is fair game. And they've executed warrants. They are free to seek out identity. So there's just been a lot more visibility of lower level people who were previously not considered a threat, a criminal threat. And so there's no hierarchy of prioritized enforcement, targets.
If they're visible in the neighborhood, obviously they must be uniformed. Otherwise, undercover, you may not know the difference. Because ICE isn't confirming any of this, correct? You're relying on community members telling you this because ICE won't comment at all.
Right. Community members, attorneys, advocacy organizations like Catholic Charities. No, they don't. They are not uniformed, but you will see, they're windbreakers with ICE on them. And then many people take exception to them using the word police, but they will have police and ICE on the back of their windbreakers. But for the most part, they're unmarked vehicles, plainclothes officers who are just out in the neighborhoods.
What are the people who work with immigrants doing to prepare for what they think will be a major raid?
What's been going on a lot of, they are distributing Know Your Rights cards in Spanish and English, which, you know, even if you are not a citizen and you're not here with legal status, you have rights. And they are making sure people know that they are not subject to illegal search or seizure. They're also having a number of community meetings and distributing separation plans that have, if I am detained and deported and say I have a citizen child who's a minor, I want my child to be in the care of her uncle, my neighbor. So they're making these legally binding separation plans that, are being notarized and have legal status.
You talked about families who are making those plans. Did you talk to anyone? What's that like for them to go through that process?
I've been talking to families about that for probably well over a year. And I think when, we as privileged Americans don't understand, as much as we may try empathetically, don't understand the conditions, hunger, poverty, violence that these people are fleeing from Central America. And, the sense I get from talking to people is this is just part of trying to survive and trying, from a parental standpoint, to give my children a chance. If my children were born here or my child has DACA, which is deferred action, which we've talked a lot about, it's just another step in a very arduous, difficult process that these people, these migrants, have got to face. And there's a real kind of, even though it wears on them, the sense I get is there's a real kind of matter-of-fact necessity to it, and they approach it in a very business-like fashion.
Another topic I want to touch on real quickly before we run out of time. 3 years ago, Sam DeBose was shot and killed by former University of Cincinnati police officer Ray Tensing. Tensing was tried twice on charges. Both of those cases ended in hung juries. This week, you had a story on Sam DeBose's children and following up with them. What are they doing and how are they doing now, 3 years after this tragic incident?
His fiancee, Sam's fiancee, DeShonda Reed, who is the mother of the three youngest children, moved to California from Springdale, and kind of to give the kids a fresh start, to get them out from underneath of the whole being the kids of Sam DeBose. She talked about vultures that are after the settlement money. Each child, by court order with the settlement from UC, is going to receive $218,000 at age 25. They're in a trust fund. But the children, she's very aware of the anger, of kind of the ongoing issues that the children are having. She tries to keep them very busy, very focused, have real open lines of communication, so very attuned to their mental health, as well as helping them try to move forward in their life, you know, and not carry too much of a burden and the sadness and the grief and the trauma that has come with this.
And I think I thought it was interesting, she's also working on a documentary about this incident.
Right. We posted on our website the trailer to the documentary, but it is concern. Her concern is not just her own children, but the children of other unarmed African American men and women who have lost their lives at the hands of police. You know, talking about again those long term issues of anger, of trauma, of you know, poor behavior, poor performance in school, antisocial behavior, and even the larger community and the kind of the psychological negative spillover that it has on the larger community. So she's pretty ambitious project, but she's a pretty driven woman, and that's where she's putting a lot of her personal energy, you know, to try to make something of value come out of the family tragedy.
Just quickly, is all the litigation in this case done? Obviously, the criminal case is over. There was a settlement with UC. Does the family plan to pursue anything against Ray Tensing personally?
I don't have this in front of me, but from what I understand, the settlement with UC from January of 2016, you know, the part of that deal, from what I understand, and I need to check it, is the family will not pursue litigation. But I do know from March, the settlement that UC made with Ray Tensing, part of that deal, the back pay and the legal fees, was he will not pursue legal action against UC or anyone else.
We've been talking about the increased activity of ICE agents in Greater Cincinnati and the three-year anniversary of the death of Sam DeBose. My guest was Cincinnati Enquirer race and communities reporter Mark Canute. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. Our assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Our intern is Layla Shakui, and our technical director was Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in for Dan Hurley. Have a great weekend.